I'm Bob Darrow, I'm an alcoholic. Well, still some people coming in from smoking stuff. So I'll tell you a little joke while they're wandering in. No, I won't. That's. I told it through my head and I thought, no, that I think it might offend half the people in the room. No.
That's all right.
Good.
We're good.
All right. A few years ago, I was in Mississippi for an AA conference. I got off the plane. I had about an hour drive from the airport to the hotel where the conference is, and this really nice couple picked me up at the airport. They were Southern Baptists. I guess there's Baptists, and there's Southern Baptists, and there's Southern Baptists. And these are the ones that see the sin in the Southern Baptists. I mean, they're the... But they're nice, nice people, really. They're very cool. We get to the hotel and I'm checking in and there's a sign on the registration desk and it says X-rated adult movies in the hotel rooms. And I could see that they were getting a little upset, especially the woman. She was seeing the sin there. And so, I like these people and I thought, well, maybe I'll try to score some points with them. I'm a bit of a people pleaser, I suppose. And I called the manager over. I said, sir, come over here. He said, what is it? I said, I want all the pornography in my hotel room to be disabled. And he looks at me and he says, you sicko, we only have regular pornography at this hotel. Some of you be driving home and get the picture. The book says in the beginning of We Agnostics, it talks about two conditions. It says if you find when you honestly want to, like really, this time you mean it, that you can't quit entirely. See, I couldn't quit entirely. You give me enough medication, I can quit for a while. But I ain't right. My alcoholism has its best with me when I get sober. I don't understand that I have this abnormal reaction to abstinence where I'm prone to everything on page 52, prone to misery and depression, a feeling of uselessness, I'm full of fear, I'm disconnected from life. I have that's that new thing, they just developed medication for it recently, social anxiety disorder. Every alcoholic I've ever known has had that feeling where you quit drinking, you don't fit, and you're afraid of people. I heard one of my favorite speakers says that he thought that other people's approval was his first drug of choice. So I can't quit entirely. And then the second thing it says, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, and then it says if that be the case, you're probably alcoholic, and you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And here's where I have a problem. You know, Wilson says something in the 12 steps and 12 traditions that I've thought about a lot over the years, and it sort of defines an aspect of this disease of perception. Wilson says that we talk a lot about problems. We do. Matter of fact, we're so obsessed with talking about problems that we've created meetings in the last 20 years where that start out, does anybody have a problem? It's like we can't get enough problem. I mean, and he says, we talk a lot about problems. Why is that? And Wilson says something that's very astute. He says, well, it's because we are problem people. Did you ever see that movie Sixth Sense where the little kid walks around and says, I see dead people? The alcoholic goes, I see problems. I see problems everywhere I go. It's like I'm constantly doing threat assessments. I'm constantly looking. I don't see the good stuff. I don't walk into a room with 20 people and see the ones that are just, oh, they're just so loving and kind. I see the problem people. The minute I walk, I see the people by their body language. I'm going to have a problem with this guy. You know, I just see that. Oh, look, she's really full of herself. Oh, what? Oh, is he? Look how he's so. He thinks he's better than everybody. You know, I see that because I see problems. And so, as a little kid, when I first started being introduced to God, I bring the mind of a chronic alcoholic, a mind that's wrapped up in itself and that does threat assessments all the time. So I don't hear about a God of love, because that's not a problem. What I hear is I hear about a God of judgment. I hear about a God who can see in the dark, which is not good for a guy like me, because that's all the fun stuff seems to be occurring in the dark, I think. I don't know. I hear about a God who exists to judge me. And he not only judges me for what I do, even if I'm doing something that's wrong and I don't know what's wrong, I'm going to get punished for not knowing. And I'll get punished even if I don't do it, but if I just think about doing it, I'm getting punished, right? I had this nun, I remember, I was a little kid in Catholic school, I'm trying to be good, I want to be good. This nun says, we must be pure of thought, word, and deed. The minute I said, I'm sitting there saying, yes, sister. And then my mind starts imagining what she looks like naked. And it's like, oh, I'm horrified. That sin's not even in the books. That's really bad. I am not going into the box in the church and tell that priest about thinking about seeing them, imagining the nuns naked. He'll come out and beat the crap out of me. You can't tell anybody that stuff. So I started developing this wealth of a secret life. That inside me, I put the facade out, you know, when I go to church, and I put the facade out with my family, this self-righteous do-gooder facade, but in secretly inside myself, I know the truth. I know I'm stained in a way that other people don't appear to be stained. Oh yeah, everybody's a sinner. Yeah, but not like me. You don't understand stuff that happened. You don't understand. And so I started to have a problem with God, basically because I don't think I'm ever going to measure up and be good enough for God. I'm the kind of guy by nature that if I just suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. You know, and it's a defense, it's a natural defense mechanism in me. So if I start suspecting I'm not going to be good enough for God, I started wanting to not be, there's no God. I became an intellectual atheist of sorts, but I'm not really an atheist. Because I've met some real atheists. To be a real atheist, you have to be very religious about your atheism. I can't get that much angst about it. I'm just afraid of God, what I really, the truth. I just feel so corrupt and so unworthy and so flawed. And I can't, so when every time I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody mentions God, it's just inside myself I turn away. Because that ain't going to be it, man. That's not it. It might be it for you people. Because some of you in AA, you looked like you did, you know, you drank. Yeah, you had a drinking problem, sure. But you didn't do some of the stuff I did. And I went quickly from the thinking it to the doing it. And there were, I did some things I hated myself for. There was a couple guys that were in prison as a result of me. Because in order to selfishly save myself, I rolled on them. There was one guy I've never found him to this day. At one time he was my only friend, probably my only and best friend at the very end, towards the end of my drinking. In a blackout, I took a hunting knife with a blade about this long, and I messed him up. He almost died. He was in intensive care for 3 weeks because I punctured his lung, and it was bad. And my parents. Loved me. They were good people. And I just destroyed them. I didn't mean to, but I did. And I knew it was me. You know, it's funny how you try to make it their fault, don't you? Well, if they would have only understood me, if they would have... You know, after a while, you can't even sell yourself your own BS. You know what I mean? You get it. That's not them, it's me. And so when you guys talk to me about God, I just cringe. I cringe and turn away because I don't think there's help there for me. But the book says, interesting enough, that on page 45, it says, see, I thought the problem is I have to believe in God or trust God, and I can't. But it says here that lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. A power to live. I can't control my emotional nature. I quit drinking. I get so depressed and so full of fear and anxiety and so lonely and so full of remorse, and I can't wish any of that stuff away. I can't make myself different. I've been to so many therapists and I've taken so many medications that give me temporary hope, and then eventually I'm back to being me again. When the shine of that stuff wears off, you know, it always does. God, if I could have found the right medication, man, I'd have never come to AA. I'd just taken that stuff. Maybe I'd come in once in a while and tell you how great I'm doing. But I'd have never worked the steps. I'd have never devoted my life to helping others. I'd have never paid back all the money. I'd have never done all that stuff. Except that I don't have a choice. And I don't know that I don't have a choice. I'm dying. And in 1978, I tried to take my own life, and I failed. Some of you figured that out. I failed, and I ended up back in Alcoholics Anonymous, and something had happened to me. And I didn't know that I was surrendered by the bottle and by my own sickness. You know, what is surrender anyway? You know, if you watch a war movie where someone is surrenders, what do? Well, the first thing they do is step away from any means of maneuvering. If they have a tank or a jeep, they walk away from it. And then the second thing they do is they lay down all their means of defending themselves. Their guns, their knife, everything, until they render themselves absolutely vulnerable and defenseless. And then they sit down and they wait for someone to tell them what to do. And that's exactly what happened to me coming off that failed suicide attempt. I met a man in 1978 in a detox who used to bring meetings in there twice a week. What an example he was of a guy who just didn't give lip service to the primary purpose. He actually lived it. He was a doer. He was a 5%er here. And he stayed, so he died with a little over 50 years sober from being old. He was a good man. And I went up to him because I heard him. I knew that somehow my defense mechanisms were down enough that I heard him and I connected. And I remember sitting there thinking as he was sharing his story, nodding my head, and I was thinking, man, I'm like this guy. I suffer like he, I get weird like he gets weird when I quit drinking. And I always go back to it. And when I drink, I ruin myself like he talks about. Because I can't stop. And yet here he is. At that time he was sober about 15 years. And something had evidently happened to him because he's not the depressive guy. And he's not taking anything. Now how does that happen? He's happy. I mean, not pretend happy. I used to watch him in the hall outside the meeting room with the detox. He'd be with a couple guys. He'd be laughing. Self-obsessed, sick people don't laugh. Everything's very serious. Because the major symptom of self-obsession is serious. When you're the center of the universe, there is a lot of things to worry about. Oh my God, it's too big. And he laughed. He walked lightly through life. He was successful. His life worked. I remember watching him in the hall laughing, carrying on with a bunch of guys, and I was thinking to myself, my God, this guy looks like he's having a better time sober than I had when alcohol still worked. And I went up to him and I asked him, I said, Would you sponsor me? And if you will, I was so scared he'd say no. I said, if you will, I'll do anything you ask me to do. And I didn't know that they actually have things they want you to do. I mean, it's not... And they start hitting me with them, you know, and none of them seem like a good idea. I mean, you know, there's not any direction I'm getting that I'm going, oh, this is good. You know, I'm not getting that for any of this stuff. But I was broken and surrendered enough, unbeknownst to me, that I just started doing what they said. And some of it was frightening. I turned myself in and offered, you know, to do the 2 years and to contact people I owed money to and contact, you know, just it was on and on and start taking these commitments and they wanted to do 12-step work. And they wanted me to pray. They said, you need to physically get down on your knees in the morning. And he didn't say I had to pray to God. Because, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous will soft sell the atheist and the agnostic into eventually having a relationship with God in a way that no church can do this the way we do it. Because we take people that are God-resistant people and just, we just softly, through their actions, they get to have an experience with God. That's transformational. And so he told me, he said, I want you to get down on your knees every morning and I want you to ask whatever's running the universe for help for that day to stay sober and help with your life and then thank that power at the end of the day. Well, I don't want to do that because I don't believe in God. I told him, I said, you know, I don't think I should do this because I don't believe in God. I'll feel like a hypocrite. And he said, hey, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it. And I just started doing it. I was in a men's halfway house, a Skid Row halfway house, and I'm in a room with bunk beds, a whole bunch of guys. I am not praying in front of those guys. I am telling you, I ain't doing it. So I go in the bathroom, I lock the door, I take the throw rope, throw it up under the crack of the door, just in case somebody tries to peek under there and see me pray. I am nuts, man, I'm nuts. And I start doing it, and funny things started happening. I've walked 300-400 guys down this road. Happens to every one of us. One of my favorite lines in the book, it says that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. You don't even have to believe. Matter of fact, I think it's better if you don't. It's better if you don't know. And I'll tell you why I think that. On page 46, it talks about two things that have to be present to get results here with step two, so you can go on to the rest of the steps to start moving towards an experiential, conscious contact rather than just a belief. And the first thing it says is we have to lay aside prejudice. You know, it's everything I think I know that gets in my way. Over the years, I've worked with 4 men of the cloth. You would think, because we are sober through the grace of God, that these guys would have a leg up on some of us. They are the hard. There is the only other person that's equally hard to sponsor is an alcoholism counselor. I mean, oh my God, because they have all this information, and all the information is in the knowledge is just fodder for their ego. And it gives them a sense of intellectual superiority and entitlement. So they don't have to lower themselves because, I mean, I studied at the Vatican. I don't have to do this stuff. I read more spiritual literature every day than you people in AA would ever read. I pray more than you ever. I'm good. I don't need to do those steps. Me and God like this. I'm his right-hand man. Just like this. Now, they don't say that because the ego wants to grandize itself and yet maintain the bragging rights of the humble. So they don't say that. They just don't want to do everything that we do here. They're too busy. I'm too busy with my child. Too busy. They have seemingly legitimate reasons. But alcoholism doesn't care any more than diabetes cares if you have a good reason not to do your insulin or not to watch your diet. Diabetes doesn't care, and neither does alcoholism. Two of these clergy, and these were good priests. We're not talking about deviant priests. These are good guys. Two of them drank themselves to death. I remember when Frank called me up a week before they found him dead, and they found him, he drowned in his, he passed out, drank so much he couldn't wake up, and drowned in his own vomit when he threw it. I mean, it was a horrible way to die. But a week before they found him dead, he'd gone back to drinking, and I was one of many guys that had tried to help him. We liked him. He was a good guy. And he's sobbing uncontrollably in the phone because he's back to drinking, and he doesn't understand why a man of his level of faith in God and his commitment to his church could ask God to keep him sober and he drinks again, when in AA there were prostitutes and drug dealers and bums and robbers, and God's keeping them sober. It didn't make any sense. And I'm only sober a couple years. It didn't make any sense to me. Because I know by now I've had an experience with God. I've had an experience with grace. I know I am sober only through the grace of God. And if that's true, you'd think that Frank would have a leg up on a guy like me. But Frank's problem wasn't lack of faith or lack of religion. It was lack of power. It was lack of access experientially to God's grace. See, faith is of the mind, but we're not talking about belief here. If you ever read William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, or even go to in meetings, you'll see it all the time. I bet you in this room there's people who've had born-again experiences and then drank after that experience. Right? See that a lot in AA. Because faith is not enough. We talk about something in AA, it's called conscious contact. And it's very different from faith, because faith is of the mind, but conscious contact is experiential. It's where you actually, with your soul, taste God. And the difference is, if you leave here and you get in your car to drive home tonight, you get out on that road with all the faith in the world that there are traffic laws and there's police to enforce them, and that faith may affect your driving. You get a cop in your rearview mirror with his lights on, you've got conscious contact. And one is real, and it's an experience, and it's not of the mind. Father Martin said something very important and very profound. He said that when things of the intellect become in conflict with the emotions always win. That's why faith isn't enough here. We've got to take it up a couple notches. And that's why the actions are so important. So the first thing is to lay aside prejudice. Can I get humble enough to know the most important thing I could ever know is I don't know? I work with guys that drink after 10, 15 years. What kills them is that they're the I know people. They have a head full of intellectual knowledge about Alcoholics Anonymous, but nothing in their heart and absolutely nothing in their feet and their actions. They die of alcoholism and they can't get back. Because what's progressed is the ego. They'll placate you. They'll go, oh, yeah, I know. I know. But they won't. They think they know. But intellectual knowledge does not help us. It's only fodder for the ego. I know guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that do big book workshops that wouldn't cross the street to help a newcomer. that are big book technicians, and then they after 20, 30 years, they drink again, or they end up doing, you know, just getting bizarre, because their ego takes the information and puffs. What's it? It puffs me up. Like when I was a counselor, I went through a period in Alcoholics Anonymous where I was doing a lot of big book stuff, and I became the guy, you know, the guy, the I know guy, right? And I started getting really sick, because this is experiential. So the second thing it says, if you can lay aside prejudice, if you can become childlike, come to God like a child who knows nothing. And then the second thing it says, and express, which is a verb, express not a belief, but even, it says, express even a willingness to believe. I started getting down on my knees and asking for help, not because I believed, but because I was willing to act like someone who was willing to possibly, maybe, someday, okay, believe. And I don't believe in God. But it did, he kept telling me, it doesn't matter. Just take the actions. And from the moment I started taking the actions, the craziest stuff started happening. All these coincidences in my life started happening that eventually, slowly convinced me that there's something here. And it must love me, because it's bringing into the flow of the universe everything I need at the moment I need it. These coincidences, how is that happening? I go over to England every summer. I do a lot of stuff over in Europe, Russia and England. But I've been doing the England thing for years. Do a big book weekend over there every summer. First time I ever went over there, I saw something startling. And you don't see it. It's almost gone to see it. There's still maybe a couple instances you can see it. But if you go down to Westminster, which is the old historical part of London, where Trafalgar Square and Hyde Park and the Parliament and all that stuff is, it's really a very cool place. The Abbey's down there, it's amazing. You know, the streets are lit by gas streetlights. And they have their technology in place, and at a certain time when the sun's going down, electronically, the computer system turns the gas on. They have electric lighters in there that light the streetlights, and then they shut them off at a certain time. It's very cool. But in the older poles, it used to be quite a few of them, but now they're getting scarcer. They keep replacing them with newer hardware. And you don't see it in the newer poles, but if you catch one of the older ones, you'll see on the side of the pole about this high is a little box with a door that has welded shut and painted over. And what that door was is, years ago, before they had the technology, there were people whose job it was to go up and down the streets of London at twilight, and they would open that little door, and they had a key. They would stick the key in, and they'd turn the gas on, and they would reach up with a long pole with a flame on it, and they'd light the street light, and then they'd go to the next one, and the next one. And you could climb up to the top of the highest building in London at twilight and look out over the city, and you could not see where the guys were lighting the lights, but you could see where they'd been. And as a result of simply positioning myself as if God might exist and taking the actions of someone who doesn't believe initially but was willing to act like a guy who maybe could believe one day, or possibly. As a result of my actions, I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at about 2 years sober, and I couldn't see at that moment where God was. But my God, I could see where he'd been in my life. And in the lives of the guys I sponsored, because you guys threw me into service when I was new. I wanted to wait and work on myself for a while. You said, you've done quite enough of that. Let's just go help people. And I could see where God was. And what happens is I eventually come to believe. I break through my own God resistance and the God barrier. And you know, we all have, I think we all have that to some degree. Even the religious people, they don't realize that they're God-resistant because they have all, a head full of information about God that they believe in intellectually. But when their emotions are putting their feet to the fire, none of it exists. And so I started to believe in this power, and I broke through the God resistance. And I tell you, here's the dangerous thing about that, is it's such an amazing thing. All of a sudden you realize one day that God's in your life and God exists and he's been helping you. Now you don't have a conscious contact, but you have a belief. And it feels like we have arrived somewhere. And in actuality, I've only arrived at the beginning of the road. There's a whole bunch of self-reduction and stuff to clean up and work to do for me to become experiential with God intermittently. And so I started this journey through the steps and the amends. And it's funny, all the actions that bring me closer to God don't look like they're going to bring me closer to God. They look like they're going to make things right with my parents and the police, and I'm going to go help others. What's this have to do with God? Funny thing, you take those actions and God, you don't even know what you're doing is you're reducing self. Because the problem for in a guy like me of having an experience with God in a conscious contact, even though it might be intermittent because of the clamoring, my head pushes it out and then it comes back and pushes it out. And the problem is I got too much of me between me and God. Just as I have too much of me between me and you. You know what? In the book, on page 55, it talks about, page 55 is a vision of what's going to happen to me as a result of if I'm diligent of steps 4 through 9. And it says, on page 55, it says, we were fooling ourselves. This is in the part of agnostics. And it's talking a lot about our doubts and prejudices and resistance. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down in me? How could something so good and so powerful be inside of something so stained and so corrupt and so weak? There was a woman that I used to go to meetings with, Diantha. Diantha was very spiritual. She was pretty cool. She died 25 years ago, I guess, cancer, but she was amazing. And she used to talk about how she would just like to be quiet and commune with God in silence. And the way she said it, like, I'm an old hippie, so that sounds cool to me, you know. And I never did that without marijuana and wine, but I think it sounds like a good idea to me. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to get quiet and go home and commune with God. Well, I haven't worked any of the steps. So when I go home and I don't turn the TV on and I don't turn the stereo and it gets quiet out here, what happens is it gets noisy in here. And after about 30 seconds, I'm having a panic attack, right? I got to turn the television on. Because when I go inside of me, I don't run into God. I just run into a whole bunch of me. I mean, because that's all that's in me, is a whole bunch of me. And I am so blocked, but I haven't done the work. I haven't cleaned out. I'm still full of myself, but I don't know it. That's the deadly thing of this disease. It never lets you see the picture. See, I thought it was some sort of mental illness. No, I'm full of myself. And the book says that's it. It says the reason that you don't have this contact inside yourself or this sense of the presence of God deep within you is that it's obscured, the book says. It means blocked by three things. The first thing is calamity. Wilson talks about the clamoring in his head, the chatter. if you were to read the Old Testament and you read Genesis in the Hebrew, when you got to the part in the Garden of Eden where they introduced the serpent, if you were to literally translate the word that they used there into the English, it was not the word they used for serpent. It was the word they used for the sound the serpent made. It was the hiss and the slither, the whisper of the serpent. It was the noise. It was the clamor. It was the little voice that says, "You don't need to tell your sponsor that. He won't understand." It's the little voice that says, "You're smarter than those people. Don't let anybody tell you what to do." It says, you should be at the helm of your ship, Bob. You know, oh, they want you to stay away from the new girl because they want her for themselves. You know, it's the voice that just it says, "Don't let your sponsor, he's old, he's out of date. Don't listen." You know, it's that voice. It's the voice that will push you and build you in a case where you'll quit your job, where you will ruin relationships. And this makes sense. Did you ever notice that the voice in your head is more reasonable than the old timers in AA? It's a very seductive voice, isn't it? It's a kind voice. It's a reasonable voice. It's a voice that when your sponsor says something, oh, when this talk to you, go, yeah. That's right. They really don't understand me. I wouldn't have done that if they hadn't have done that. It's a good voice. It's the voice of the enemy. It's the clamor of the ego. It's the source of all my problems. So I may be blocked by that. I mean, on a bad day, when you're agitated, I mean, if God really was inside you, if he's trying to talk to you, he'd have to have even if he had a megaphone, I'm not going to hear it over all the clamor in my own head. The second thing that blocks me from God is pomp. I'm so full of myself and my opinions and, well, the things I'm right about. You know, I'm right about you. I go to meetings. I don't hear nothing because I just sit there and discount. I see how stupid you all are. I had a great psychiatrist, Abe Tversky. I was in three treatment centers in the Pittsburgh area where he lectured. The third one, he finally got tired of seeing me. And he told me something I've never forgotten. I didn't understand it at the time. But he said to me, he says, "Guys like you don't get any better." He said, "You may find a way to not drink for decades, but you're never going to get better." And he said, "The reason is that even though you have no self-esteem and no self-worth, you're a depressive. Your ego is so big that you can't listen to anyone in order to hear anything new. You're only capable of listening to see how you're already right." I just thought he was an asshole. Right? But he was right. That's exact, because I'm full of my pomp. I'm pompous. I'm arrogant in my feelings of worthlessness. And then the third thing, it says worship of other things. You know, it's funny. You could have asked me when I was early in sobriety, now that you're sober, Bob, do you worship anything? I'd have said, no, man. I mean, maybe when I was drinking, I worshiped alcohol and drugs, I guess. But no, I'm a free man. I had no idea. And I was a little over a year sober, and I was ending my first sober relationship. And I'll tell you, I've sponsored a lot of guys that go through that, and I don't think there is a human being on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. Oh my God. You can go up to a guy like that and say, "You know, I just came from the doctor, I have terminal cancer, 2 weeks to live," and he'll go, "You know what else she said?" You know, I mean, it's just, you just get it right here, you can't get it off. I mean, it's just right here, and it's making me insane. And I'm nuts, I'm gut shot, I'm crazy. And I go to a meeting because I don't know what else to do. I just thinking I'll hear something that'll snap me out of it. But when you're like that, you're disassociated from reality because what goes on in the meeting, it could be God trying to talk to you from the people there, but it's like music in the doctor's office because the big show's on the inside, right? And I can't hear nothing because I'm in my head. She's a member of AA. She's not in that meeting, but I know I'm going to run into her in a meeting. When I run into her, I'm going to say this, and then she'll say that, and then I'm going to say this, and of course she'll say that. And when she says that, I'm going to hit her with this, and she'll realize how wrong she was and be properly ashamed of herself and beg for me to come back. Well, God's trying to talk to me through the meeting, and I'm just in the big shows in here. And because she's not in that meeting, some hideous force has attached a bungee cord to the base of my neck to the meeting room door. Every time the door opens, I go, oh, not her. Oh, not her. Right? So by the end of the meeting, the meeting has not helped me at all. Matter of fact, I'm worse, it seems like. And I end up going out to coffee with a visitor from California who was sober a long time. The people in AA are tired of me talking about this relationship. Well, I got fresh meat here, and I get this old timer, and I got him in a booth in a restaurant. I got him hostage, and I start telling him about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes until his eyes have glazed over. A very kind man, and he listens to me and nods his head. And then when I was done, he said some things to me that it was like he lifted some veils, and all of a sudden I could see some things that were true that I never could see before. He said, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? When he said that, I didn't even know. I still bristled with a little bit of prejudice about my childhood religion. And I said to him, oh, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he starts laughing at me. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, you and I are a lot alike. He said, guys like us have a hard time with that thou shalt not part of the Ten Commandments. He said, but originally, when they were written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. And as they were translated into another language before they got to the English, there was an authoritarian spin put on them by some well-intentioned people that were trying to make people act better, I suppose. And he said, the first commandment as it exists now in the English is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. He said, I know absolutely that God loves me and he loves you. And there's nothing you can do that will get him to not love you. You can put anything you want because you've got free will between you and God still loves you. The problem is you just put something between you and God. You just block the light. He said, when you worship something, it doesn't mean to bow down. It just simply means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards something. He said, you want to know if you're worshiping anything? Make a pie graph at the end of the day of everything you've been thinking about. And the thing that would dominate the pie would obviously be the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. When he said that, it was hideous. I see the pie graph in my mind. It was like a little tiny thing for AA, a little bit for work, and the whole freaking pie graph was this relationship. And I knew why it felt like someone had stepped on the oxygen hose to my soul. Because I blocked the flow of grace and love from God. I was consumed with myself. The problem, what makes me sick when I get sober, is that I'm in the bondage of self, but I don't know it. And what that means is I just got me right here, and I can't get me off of me. And if you're like that, you'll end up, you may be a worrier starting out until the things you worry about are so overwhelming you will implode, as I used to, into a deep depression of hopelessness because I can't control any of it. When I would sit in psychiatrist's office and I'd try to tell them sometimes what was wrong with me, and they'd say, well, what's wrong, Bob? I don't know. It's just that nothing's right. If you ask me what I was afraid of, Everything. I just, this doesn't discriminate. It's everything in the universe is problematic to this, in some sense. The future. Do you ever sit and just ponder your future? Do you ever do that and spiral upward? No, I don't. If you do, God bless you. You're a half glass of water, half full person. I am not. You give me 20 minutes to just think about my life and where it's going, and I'll just want to shoot myself. I get up in the morning and I have a little ache in my arm or something. I just go to bone cancer. You know, I've imagined. It's funny. My doctor. We have this joke going on because this doesn't own me anymore, but it used to. It used to own me. But now, when I go in the doctor, he'll say, "What's wrong?" I go, "Oh, it's that pesky brain tumor's back again." You know, and he just laughs because he's an AA. You know, he gets it. He gets it. By the way, I just had a conversation with him. I think not last year, most alcoholics, because we're narcissistically self-involved and full of fear and problem-seeking missiles, we all lend ourselves easily to hypochondria. I mean, I'm curious, did anybody here, and besides myself, ever imagined you had a terminal illness that you found out later you really didn't have? Right. Well, he said to me something. I asked him, I was talking about it. I said, is there any disease a hypochondriac doesn't imagine he has at one time or another? And he said, yeah, alcoholism. It's true. And I had brain tumors, I had bone, I had all kinds of stuff. But I never, it's never, even in sobriety, when I'm a mess, it never occurs to me that it's alcoholism. And yet, every problem I've had in my life can be hung on the hook of the spiritual malady of alcoholism. It's what makes me crazy. It makes me physically sick at times. You get it bad enough, you'll develop an ulcer. You'll develop all kinds of physical debilities. And the great news, and I know this is true. I've had this experience, and I've had it with dozens of guys I sponsor. The book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That is a miracle. For a guy who spent as many years in psychiatrist's offices as I have, to stand before you, and I am different. Not once and for all, I'm different, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I love that. I love knowing that I can bet my life on Alcoholics Anonymous if I'm just willing to show up and do the actions. That AA will not let me down. I can let it down. I can fill up with myself till I have a sense of entitlement and become a self-seeker and a self-server again. But if I stay in the game of self-abandonment and service, I never have to worry about nothing. Thanks. Bow.
Raise your mic for me. But it makes me uncomfortable having this in front of me.
I can't have you uncomfortable.
I know, I gotta stand up straight. It's just, I'm not even gonna say it. You know what I'm thinking. All right. Hey, where's the basket? The money collector. There's money out there. We agnostics. When I finally surrendered to this chapter, I actually found myself in this chapter. And I was about 3 years sober. And I don't know if it was an emotional bottom. I don't know about that stuff. I don't know. Or a darkness soul. Or all of that. I don't know. However, I was pretty desperate sober. And that's when I really discovered the agnostics and found that I was an agnostic and had been for a very, very long time. My sponsor that I had once talked about always knowing that his answer would be spiritual in nature, because every time he got into trouble or hit some kind of bottom or consequence when he was out there running around, he'd run to church or run to some type of spiritual awakening, trying to create that or make that happen. And when I heard him say that, I identified with that. When I look back, I was raised Episcopalian, Catholic light, I guess some people call that. And I didn't feel anything when I sat in church at all. I wanted to. It seemed like other people were, but I did not experience anything there. My grandmother was Southern Baptist, and when I got older, I got, you know, when the devil was on me, I got pulled to several evangelical tent revival type experiences, and those were, they were frightening to me, especially coming from, you know, the uptight Episcopalian WASPI experience, and then going to something like that, where they're laying hands on you, and, you know, you go up there because you want to be saved, and you're ready to, you know, renounce yourself and be a good person. And I was hoping that those things would happen, but those things didn't happen. And I would be moved by the emotion of it and also the fear of what was happening in my life where I had to change. And it was never anything that lasted for me. It never fully solved my problem. Sometimes it would last a night, sometimes a week, but eventually I showed back up. And I never understood why. I never understood why that stuff didn't work. So I started to develop, I think that's where I started to develop my agnosticisms towards God, that I went and tried these spiritual experiences or these, went to God and the godly places where you're supposed to be able to find them, and nothing happened. So I turned my back on that and for a period of time considered myself an atheist and believed that the intellect could overcome it all. So anyway, when I came back into AA this time, or crawled back in here, I was a little bit more open-minded about God. I, you know, had asked God for help. I didn't really have any feeling about that either, one way or the other. And, you know, I'm going to meetings and in AA, you know, we talk about God. And people were saying, you got to start praying and keeping the actions really simple for me. You know, put your slippers under the bed, which I just thought was ridiculous, but whatever. What I did is I said I would do it, but I didn't do it. I said, okay. And then, you know, my sponsor asked me, did you do it? And I'm like, oh, yeah. Well, how are you feeling? Great. I'm fine. You know, because I didn't get it. Now I would pray, but I prayed on my terms. And it was embarrassing to me. It was humbling to me. It was very vulnerable to me. I didn't think of a loving God, a loving creator. That was not my perception. But through taking action, something happened, and I had, you know, what a lot of people in AA call that peak cloud experience, and that happened when I was around 6 months sober, and it was from going to meetings and trying to be of service and taking a stab at these steps, and, you know, things were just starting to change, and I kind of had the billboard experience of God where you feel good, like, woohoo, God, yay, and I thought that was it. And walked around with that. When I look back on it, with some hindsight, it was God was just about a feeling to me, and I was looking for that feeling, and that was what determined whether I was having a relationship with God or not. And eventually, that feeling passes, but you know, I'm still going to meetings and still doing the deals, still trying to help people, and my life is getting really, really uncomfortable again. Because I've been down that road before, you know, sober for, you know, around 3 years, and around this time, 3 years, I started getting a little itchy, scratchy again. And my life isn't working, and I thought AA would work. I feel like I'm doing all this stuff that you guys have asked me to do, and it's not working. My life's falling apart. And through my actions, I lost everything sober. No car, no job, no money, no place to live, nothing. Sleeping on my ex-husband's sofa. All my stuff in little green garbage bags in his basement. It's humiliating. I hated AA at that point. Hated the people in AA. I thought AA did not work. That there was not a God that cared about me. I absolutely believed that there were the haves and the have-nots in this spiritual walk, and I was a have-not. I hated the people that would get up to the podium and talk about how they sobered up and their life was just beautiful. You know, and they got the hot new relationship, the hot job, the hot car, all the money in the world. Hated them. And it just fed that idea that there's haves and have-nots here. And some people get a special connection to God and some people don't. Because I thought I was doing everything and God was withholding from me. That God was giving all these little spiritual goodies out to everybody but me. And I was pissed. So that soon turned into, like Bob talked about, just suicidal depression and homicidal rage, depending on the hour in the day. And then I really wanted to die, because being sober with no hope and a power greater than myself and no understanding about that or experience with that, or very limited, I just felt like this is not going to work for me. There was nothing left for me. And I just wanted out of here. And I wanted off this path. And it doesn't work. And thank God I met somebody who saved my life and really started to take me through re-agnostics and started to help me identify my agnosticisms, or whatever you want to call that, and what my old ideas were. At the time, I couldn't have even articulated that. I was so not conscious of what was going on in my mind about what I really believed about God and what I really believed about these spiritual terms. And you know, I was just telling God to F off on a regular basis. And, I mean, thank God for the wisdom of people that have been around. It's like, well, at least you're talking to them, you know? At least we know you got some kind of belief. It's distorted, but, you know, we can start somewhere. But I absolutely had fallen into a very punitive, judgmental, you got to do this stuff perfect or you're not going anywhere or getting any relief. God. I remember calling my sponsor one time and was really upset, and my sponsor said, well, what are you praying to? And I said, well, I think God is mean. I think God is vindictive. I think God is punishing. I think God is withholding. And he's a real, you know, ill-mouther. And my sponsor said, well, you've got God set up as a version of you. I mean, that was a low blow. That was not very kind at all. But it's true. You know, and I had not, I mean, God for me was still very human. You know, God's not human. But I had assigned all these fearful human characteristics on this God and had become completely closed-minded. And those were the things, my old ideas, my prejudices that I had to set aside. And, you know, we just followed those drugs. We just set them aside. God, help me to set this aside. You know, am I willing to let go of this? Am I willing to believe that maybe what I think about God isn't true? Now, I was willing to believe it because I saw in my sponsor somebody who was alive, awake and alive, and had a very loving relationship with the God of his understanding. And I wanted that. His life made sense to him. And I wanted to have that experience. So, anyway, I'm not telling that story. Anyway, so we set that stuff aside. God, help me set aside what I think I know about you. All the stuff that's in here that it talks about God being a flimsy reed. You know, and like I'm a drowning person holding on to that flimsy reed. That is to the T how I felt. That God, this idea of God, this idea that God's going to solve my problems, if I'll just be willing to believe, you know, that absolutely felt like a flimsy reed. I mean, I got serious problems in my life, man. And you're telling me that my life's going to be put back together, that I'm going to be the experience the opposite of what I'm experiencing now, which is, you know, I'm 52, the bedevilments. If I can just begin to believe. And thank God for sponsorship, because my sponsor talked to me about in here how it talks about in setting all that stuff aside, that I could have a relationship that was simple and understandable to me. Now, for someone like me, because I love stuff that satisfies the mind. I mean, I get that with it being ego fire. I love that stuff. I lost my train of thought, sorry. Simple and understandable. I need more coffee. Anyway. Simple was tough for me because I wanted to understand God. And I needed to have the perfect conception so I could have perfect results, which I had an idea of what those results were going to look like if I did this just right. And I was able to articulate that and then let that go. And just to keep it really, really simple and understandable to me. And that principle was just a merciful, loving Father. That was the simple, understandable term for me. And I was also reminded, and where that came from was I was reminded, because I had, you know, that idea too, that you gotta be good for God, and there's just no way. You know, that perfectionistic stuff, was that God met me and brought me here when I was not leading a stellar life. I was not a nice person. I was destroying everything and harming everybody.
that was in contact with me. I was a liar. I was a thief. Complete wreckage. And I was given the gift of sobriety. God met me there, and I was not a good person. And that I was loved. So stuff like that is what started to kind of chip away at my icy intellectual mountain that I had created. So I could be changed and start to have a different experience. And when I was in so much pain and so desperate, I would read this stuff, these promises and we agnostics, and I'm like, this stuff better be true. I better feel some new power flowing into me, because I'm going to die if I don't. And I knew it. And I had nowhere else to go. Nowhere else to go. So, I mean, I was banking on this stuff. It wasn't like, woohoo, this sounds nice and feels good kind of crap. It was like, this stuff better be true. And I also started to believe, like Bob said, believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. And believe that these things could happen for me like they had happened for other people. That I wasn't different. I just had to be willing to do what they had done. If I could acquire a relationship through reading spiritual literature, hell, I would have arrived a long time ago. But it is the faith, you know, faith without the works is dead. You know, I have to be willing to take the actions. And that's when the experience starts to happen. And my actions was to, in this piece in step two, is to honestly look at what I really believed about God and talk about that. And really ask myself some questions about what do I really believe about God. And am I willing to believe that this power will solve my problems? You know, and I think somewhere, well, I think it says in our book that spiritual principles will solve all our problems. You know, my sponsor said, all means all, Valerie. And I'm like, does that mean my financial problems? Yep. Does that mean my relationship problems? Yeah. My work problems? My mental problems, you know, my depression, you know, my anger, all that stuff. It's going to solve all these problems, all of them, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense how getting a relationship with God, that God is going to fix all that, you know, because I'm thinking, I got to fix it. I gotta make it happen. I mean, that's how I grew up. You make it happen. You want it, you go get it. You make it happen. And there's nothing, I can't make anything happen. It was a rude awakening to me when I realized I couldn't manage my spiritual life. Because, you know, I want to be a spiritual guru. I don't know about you. But I want to arrive here. I said that. Don't ever say that to your sponsor. I said that to my sponsor, and my sponsor just said, well, there is, I said, I just want to get there. You know, that place of, you know, the spiritual unicorn with rainbows coming out your ass, you know? And I want to get there. You know, where you're beloved by everybody and nothing pisses you off and people seek you out for your profoundness. And your healing touch, you know. Yeah. I want to get there. And my son said, well, there is no there. And I felt let down. Because I want to get there. So that's actually the good news for me today. There is no there. There is no arriving here. There's no arriving on the spiritual path. Maybe there is when you're dead. Hell, I don't know. But I know while you're walking around here, there isn't. And that's what I like about, you know, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive. It's open. But it's broad, it's roomy. The longer I'm sober, the broader it gets, the roomier it gets. I'm not as nearly as rigid with the God of my understanding like I used to be, nor with other people or myself. I remember my sponsor saying to me, if you really want to know what your relationship is with God, all you have to do is look at your other relationships. That'll tell you everything. Are you rigid in your relationships? Are you demanding, angry? Are you not getting yours? You know? Yes, check, check, check. You know, stuff like that. So, I needed a new conception. My ideas about God needed to change. And they have. And it's not been an overnight matter. And they continue to change. I still run up against my own fear of God, my own lack of faith, my own old ideas. They still show up today. And it's the it's the opportunity, I'm trying to find the word, says it is the opportunity to continue to grow. I know for someone like me, I have to have a relationship with God. I don't live well without one. When I didn't have a relationship with God, I was not a nice person. I will lie to you. I will take from you. I will be mean to you. I'm not nice. I'm not interested really in you. When I don't have a relationship with God, I don't live well. You know, that's why they say we have to find power by which we can live. Because I don't live well without it. I don't. I end up homeless with no car, no job, no money, no place to live, all my stuff in little green garbage bags. That's what happens to me. When I am God in my life. So, I'm happy to report that my relationship with God today is a kind one. It's not punitive at all. You know, and I've been kind of like what I guess some people call a spiritual desert this last year. And I'm so grateful that I know that my relationship with God is not dependent on how I feel or whether I feel God's presence or not. And that's a huge gift for someone like me, that I am willing and have been given the power to go sit quietly and not feel anything, but I'm there because I love my Creator. That's not power that comes from within me. That's not, it's a gift that I've been given that I don't understand. And one of the biggest problems that I have is I try to understand. And I try to figure it out and put words on it. A friend of mine says, you know, you can't wrap your mind around spiritual principles, and it's true. I will put a limited wrap on it. My limited wrap. The best I can come up with it, which is very limited. So, I absolutely know God restores us to sanity. A, I haven't had a drink in a long time. And my life is full today, even in the presence of so much unknown. So, God's absolutely restored me to sanity. And I'm still coming to believe in the power of God. It's still growing. My faith is still growing. So there for me, it's been, there is no end to it. And it is getting past my mind and what I think and letting go. I mean, it's not like I got anywhere else to go anyway. I mean, mean, it can be kind of interesting sometimes to think about it. You know, here, I'm going to do it. Here's the crude reference. You know, it's like mental masturbation. You never orgasm. It's just not going to happen. You can play with it all day. You can have fun with it all day long. Nothing at the end. It's just not going to happen. So, anyway, that's, you know. It's about the action and the willingness, you know. I think I'm going to shut up.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Bob and Valerie. We look forward to tomorrow. For those of you that haven't had an opportunity, we're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. This group gives to the AA service structure and also allows us to have events like this. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Will all home group members please raise your hand? All right. See one of us if you're looking for a home group. Or if you have a question about what one is. I know earlier tonight we asked for people who were within their first 30 days. And at this time, I'm just going to talk to you about the sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, if you'll raise your hand. Thank you. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, see one of us after the meeting. We'll be glad to talk to you. Reminder for smokers to please use the buck can provided outside and stay well away from the church. And all of our meetings are recorded. This is being recorded as well as our Monday night meetings. And you can check them out on our website, simpleactions.net. And in closing, if you'll help me thank our panel again, Bob and Valerie. So tomorrow morning, we're going to be back here at 9 o'clock in the morning. Bob and Valerie are going to talk about trusting God and cleaning house. At 12 o'clock, we have a potluck lunch. Bring a dish if you wish. At 1 o'clock, we'll start back again with helping others, and we'll adjourn tomorrow at 2:30. We'd love to have everyone back tomorrow. Tonight, the meeting after the meeting, a lot of us have not had dinner yet. So we're going to head down to Plaza del Sol. It's on Colonial and 22nd. A little Mexican restaurant down there. All are welcome to join us. And before we close tonight, we've got these chairs here in these two sections. We're going to need to move them away, maybe stack them in groups of eight. And we've got 14 tables back there that we're going to set up. And if y'all could help us to move these chairs, bring the tables in, and put eight chairs around each of the tables, that would be great. So that we'll be ready tomorrow. We're going to sit at tables tomorrow, and then we'll be ready for our potluck lunch at 12 o'clock. And I've asked Judy to come up to read for us tonight. She's going to be reading from page 164, the last two paragraphs, if anyone would like to join along in their book.
I'm Judy, an alcoholic.
Hey, Judy.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
And we're going to close tonight with the Lord's Prayer for those of us that care to join. We're going to make a big circle.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
Keep coming back.